Anti-Fragile, Things That Gain from Disorder, by Nassim Nicholas Taleb. Chapter 15. Rewriting the History of Technology. How, in science, history is rewritten by the losers, and how I saw it in my own business, and how we can generalize. Does knowledge of biology hurt medicine? Hiding the role of luck. What makes a good entrepreneur? History written by the losers. The birds may perhaps listen. Combining stupidity with wisdom rather than the opposite. Where we look for the arrow of discovery. A vindication of trial and error. Because of a spate of biases, historians are prone to epiphenomena and other illusions of cause and effect. To understand the history of technology, you need accounts by non-historians, or historians with the right frame of mind, who develop their ideas by watching the formation of technologies, instead of just reading accounts concerning it. I mentioned earlier Terence Keeley's debunking of the so-called linear model, and that he was a practicing scientist. A practicing laboratory scientist, or an engineer, can witness the real-life production of, say, pharmacological innovations or the jet engine, and can thus avoid falling for epiphenomena, unless he was brainwashed prior to starting practice. I have seen evidence, as an eyewitness, of results that owe nothing to academizing science, rather evolutionary tinkering that was dressed up and claimed to have come from academia. Table 5. The lecturing birds how to fly effect across domains, example of misattribution of results in textbooks. The origination of the jet engine is marketed as physicists, busted by Scranton, but it actually came from tinkering engineers with no understanding of why it works. The origination of architecture is marketed as Euclidean geometry and mathematics, busted by Bourgeois. But it actually came from heuristics and secret recipes, guilds. The origination of cybernetics is marketed as Norbert Wiener, busted by Mendel. But it actually came from programmers, wiki-style. The origination of derivatives formulas is marketed as Black, Scholes, and Fragilista Merton, busted by Haug and Taleb. But it actually came from traders and practitioners, Raynaud, Bachelier, Thorpe. The origination of medicine is marketed as biological understanding, busted by a long series of doctors. But it actually came from luck, trial and error, side effects of other medicines, or sometimes poisoning, mustard gas. The origination of the Industrial Revolution is marketed as growth in knowledge, scientific revolution, busted by Keeley. But it actually came from adventurers and hobbyists. The origination of technology is marketed as formal science, but it actually came from technology and businesses. Long before I knew the results in Table 5 of other scholars debunking the lecturing birds how to fly effect, the problem started screaming at me as follows around 1998. I was sitting in a Chicago restaurant with the late Fred A., an economist, though a true, thoughtful gentleman. He was the chief economist of one of the local exchanges and had to advise them on new, complicated financial products and wanted my opinion on these, as I specialized in and had published a textbook of sorts on the so-called very complicated exotic options. He recognized that the demand for these products was going to be very large, but he wondered how traders could handle these complicated exotics if they did not understand the Gersonoff theorem. The Gersonoff theorem is something mathematically complicated that at the time was only known by a very small number of persons. And we were talking about pit traders who, as we saw in the last chapter, would most certainly mistake Gersonoff for a vodka brand. Traders, usually uneducated, were considered overeducated if they could spell their street address correctly, while the professor was truly under the epiphenomenal impression that traders studied mathematics to produce an option price. I, for myself, had figured out by trial and error and picking the brains of experienced people how to play with these complicated payoffs before I heard of these theorems. Something hit me then. Nobody worries that a child ignorant of the various theorems of aerodynamics and incapable of solving an equation of motion would be unable to ride a bicycle. So why didn't he transfer the point from one domain to another? Didn't he realize that these Chicago pit traders respond to supply and demand little more in competing to make a buck, with no need for the Gersonov theorem, any more than a trader of pistachios in the souk of Damascus needs to solve general equilibrium equations to set the price of his product? For a minute, I wondered if I was living on another planet, or if the gentleman's Ph.D. in research career had led to this blindness and his strange loss of common sense, or if people without practical sense usually manage to get the energy and interest to acquire a Ph.D. in the fictional world of equation economics. Is there a selection bias? I smelled a rat and got extremely excited, but realized that for someone to be able to help me, he had to be both a practitioner and a researcher, with practice coming before research. I knew of only one other person, a trader turned researcher, Espen Haug, who had to have observed the same mechanism. Like me, he got his doctorate after spending time in trading rooms. So we immediately embarked on an investigation about the source of the option pricing formula that we were using. What did people use before? Is it thanks to the academically derived formula that we are able to operate? Or did the formula come through some anti-fragile evolutionary discovery process based on trial and error, now expropriated by academics? I already had a hint, as I had worked as a pit trader in Chicago and had observed veteran traders who refused to touch mathematical formulas, using simple heuristics and saying real men don't use sheets, the sheets being the printouts of output from the complex formulas that came out of computers. Yet these people had survived. Their prices were sophisticated and more efficient than those produced by the formula, and it was obvious what came first. For instance, the prices accounted for extremiston and fat tails, which the standard formulas ignored. Haug has some interests that diverge from mine. He was into the subject of finance and eager to collect historical papers by practitioners. He called himself the collector, even used it as a signature, as he went to assemble and collect books and articles on option theory written before the Great War, and from there we built a very precise image of what had taken place. To our great excitement, we had proof after proof that traders had vastly, vastly more sophistication than the formula, and their sophistication preceded the formula by at least a century. It was, of course, picked up through natural selection, survivorship, apprenticeship to experienced practitioners, and one's own experience. Traders trade, then traders figure out techniques and products, then academic economists find formulas and claim traders are using them, then new traders believe academics, then blow-ups from theory-induced fragility. Our paper sat for close to 7 years before publication by an academic economics journal. Until then, a strange phenomenon. It became one of the most downloaded papers in the history of economics, but was not cited at all during its first few years. Nobody wanted to stir the pot. Practitioners don't write. They do. Birds fly, and those who lecture them are the ones who write their story. So it is easy to see that history is truly written by losers with time on their hands and a protected academic position. The greatest irony is that we watched firsthand how narratives of thought are made, as we were lucky enough to face another episode of blatant intellectual expropriation. We received an invitation to publish our side of the story, being option practitioners, in the Honorable Wiley Encyclopedia of Quantitative Finance. So we wrote a version of the previous paper, mixed with our own experiences. Shock. We caught the editor of the historical section, one Barnard College professor, red-handed trying to modify our account. A historian of economic thought, he proceeded to rewrite our story to play down, if not reverse, its message and change the arrow of the formation of knowledge. This was scientific history in the making. The fellow sitting in his office in Barnard College was now dictating to us what we saw as traitors. We were supposed to override what we saw with our own eyes, with his logic. I came to notice a few similar inversions of the formation of knowledge. For instance, in his book written in the late 1990s, the Berkeley professor, highly certified fragilista Mark Rubinstein, attributed to publications by finance professors techniques and heuristics that we practitioners had been extremely familiar with, often in more sophisticated forms, since the 1980s, when I got involved in the business. No, We don't put theories into practice. We create theories out of practice. That was our story, and it is easy to infer from it, and from similar stories, that the confusion is generalized. The theory is the child of the cure, not the opposite. Ex cura teoria nascitur. The evidence staring at us. It turned out that engineers, too, get sandbagged by historians. Right after the previous nauseating episode, I presented the joint paper I had written with Haug on the idea of lecturing birds on how to fly in finance at the London School of Economics in their Sociology of Science seminar. I was, of course, heckled, but was by then very well trained at being heckled by economists. Then, surprise. At the conclusion of the session, the organizers informed me that, exactly a week earlier, Phil Scranton, a professor from Rutgers, had delivered the exact same story. But it was not about the option formula, it was about the jet engine. Scranton showed that we have been building and using jet engines in a completely trial-and-error experiential manner, without anyone truly understanding the theory. Builders needed the original engineers who knew how to twist things to make the engine work. Theory came later, in a lame way, to satisfy the intellectual bean counter. But that's not what you tend to read in standard histories of technology. My son, who studies aerospace engineering, was not aware of this. Scranton was polite and focused on situations in which innovation is messy, distinguished from more familiar analytic and synthetic innovation approaches, as if the latter were the norm, which it is obviously not. I looked for more stories, and the historian of technology David Edgerton presented me with a quite shocking one. We think of cybernetics, which led to the cyber in cyberspace, as invented by Norbert Wiener in 1948. The historian of engineering David Mindell debunked the story. He showed that Wiener was articulating ideas about feedback control and digital computing that had long been in practice in the engineering world. Yet people, even today's engineers, have the illusion that we owe the field to Wiener's mathematical thinking. Then I was hit with the following idea. We all learn geometry from textbooks based on axioms, like, say, Euclid's Book of Elements, and tend to think that it is thanks to such learning that we today have these beautiful geometric shapes in buildings, from houses to cathedrals. To think the opposite would be anathema. So I speculated immediately that the ancients developed an interest in Euclid's geometry and other mathematics because they were already using these methods, derived by tinkering and experiential knowledge. Otherwise, they would not have bothered at all. This is similar to the story of the wheel. Recall that the steam engine had been discovered and developed by the Greeks some 2 millennia before the Industrial Revolution. It is just that things that are implemented tend to want to be born from practice, not theory. Now take a look at architectural objects around us. They appear so geometrically sophisticated, from the pyramids to the beautiful cathedrals of Europe. So a sucker problem would make us tend to believe that mathematics led to these beautiful objects, with exceptions here and there, such as the pyramids, as these preceded the more formal mathematics we had after Euclid and other Greek theorists. Some facts. Architects, or what were then called masters of works, relied on heuristics, empirical methods, and tools, and almost nobody knew any mathematics. According to the medieval science historian Guy Baujouan, before the 13th century, no more than 5 persons in the whole of Europe knew how to perform a division. No theorem schmearum. But builders could figure out the resistance of materials without the equations we have today. Buildings that are, for the most part, still standing. The 13th-century French architect Villard d'Ancourt documents with his series of drawings and notebooks in Picard, the language of the Picardy region in France, how cathedrals were built. Experimental heuristics, small tricks, and rules, later tabulated by Philibert Delorme in his architectural treatises. For instance, a triangle was visualized as the head of a horse. Experimentation can make people much more careful than theories. Further, we are quite certain that the Romans, admirable engineers, built aqueducts without mathematics. Roman numerals did not make quantitative analysis very easy. Otherwise, I believe, these would not be here, as a patent side effect of mathematics is making people over-optimize and cut corners, causing fragility. Just look how the new is increasingly more perishable than the old. and take a look at Vitruvius's manual, De Architectura, the Bible of Architects, written about 300 years after Euclid's Elements. There is little formal geometry in it, and, of course, no mention of Euclid, mostly heuristics, the kind of knowledge that comes out of a master guiding his apprentices. Tellingly, the main mathematical result he mentions is Pythagoras's theorem, amazed that the right angle could be formed without the contrivances of the artisan. Mathematics had to have been limited to mental puzzles until the Renaissance. Now, I am not saying that theories or academic science are not behind some practical technologies at all, directly derived from science for their final use, not for some tangential use. What the researcher Joel Mocher calls an epistemic base, or propositional knowledge, a sort of repository of formal knowledge that embeds the theoretical and empirical discoveries and becomes a rulebook of sorts, used to generate more knowledge and, he thinks, more applications. In other words, a body of theories from which further theories can be directly derived. But let's not be suckers. Following Mr. Mocher would make one want to study economic geography to predict foreign exchange prices. I would have loved to introduce him to the expert in green lumber. While I accept the notion of epistemic base, what I question is the role it has really played in the history of technology. The evidence of a strong effect is not there, and I am waiting for someone to show it to me. Mocher and the advocates of such view provide no evidence that it is not epiphenomenal, nor do they appear to understand the implications of asymmetric effects. Where is the role of optionality in this? There is a body of know-how that was transmitted from master to apprentice, and transmitted only in such a manner, with degrees necessary as a selection process, or to make the profession more respectable, or to help here and there, but not systematically. And the role of such formal knowledge will be overappreciated precisely because it is highly visible. Is it like cooking? Cooking seems to be the perfect business that depends on optionality. You add an ingredient and have the option of keeping the result if it is in agreement with Fat Tony's taste buds, or forget about it if it's not. We also have wiki-style collaborative experimentation, leading to a certain body of recipes. These recipes are derived entirely without conjectures about the chemistry of taste buds, with no role for any epistemic base to generate theories out of theories. Nobody is fooled so far by the process. As Dan Ariely once observed, we cannot reverse engineer the taste of food from looking at the nutritional label, and we can observe ancestral heuristics at work, generations of collective tinkering resulting in the evolution of recipes. These food recipes are embedded in cultures. Cooking schools are entirely apprenticeship-based. On the other side, we have pure physics, with theories used to generate theories with some empirical validation. There, the epistemic base can play a role. The discovery of the Higgs boson is a modern case of a particle entirely expected from theoretical derivations. So was Einstein's relativity. Prior to the Higgs boson, one spectacular case of a discovery with a small number of existing external data is that of the French astronomer Le Verrier's derivation of the existence of the planet Neptune. He did that on the basis of solitary computation from the behavior of the surrounding planets. When the planet was actually sighted, he refused to look at it, so comfortable was he with his result. These are exceptions, and tend to take place in physics and other places I call linear, where errors are from mediocristan, not from extremistan. Now, use this idea of cooking as a platform to grasp other pursuits. Do other activities resemble it? If we put technologies through scrutiny, we would see that most do, in fact, resemble cooking a lot more than physics, particularly those in the complex domain. Even medicine today remains an apprenticeship model with some theoretical science in the background, but made to look entirely like science. And if it leaves the apprenticeship model, it would be for the evidence-based method that relies less on biological theories and more on the cataloging of empirical regularities, the phenomenology I explained in Chapter 7. Why is it that science comes and goes and technologies remain stable? Now, one can see a possible role for basic science, but not in the way it is intended to be. For an example of a chain of unintended uses, let us start with Phase 1, the computer. The mathematical discipline of combinatorics, here basic science, derived from propositional knowledge, led to the building of computers, or so the story goes. And, of course, to remind the reader of cherry-picking, we need to take into account the body of theoretical knowledge that went nowhere. But at first, nobody had an idea what to do with these enormous boxes full of circuits, as they were cumbersome, expensive, and their applications were not too widespread, outside of database management, only good to process quantities of data. It is as if one needed to invent an application for the thrill of technology. Baby boomers will remember those mysterious punch cards. Then someone introduced the console to input with the aid of a screen monitor, using a keyboard. This led, of course, to word processing, and the computer took off because of its fitness to word processing, particularly with the microcomputer in the early 1980s. It was convenient, but not much more than that, until some other unintended consequence came to be mixed into it. Now phase two, the Internet. It had been set up as a resilient military communication network device, developed by a research unit of the Department of Defense called DARPA, and got a boost the days when Ronald Reagan was obsessed with the Soviets. It was meant to allow the United States to survive a generalized military attack. Great idea, but add the personal computer plus Internet, and we get social networks, broken marriages, a rise in nerdiness, the ability for a post-Soviet person with social difficulties to find a matching spouse. All that thanks to U.S. tax dollars, or rather budget deficit, during Reagan's anti-Soviet crusade. So for now, we are looking at the forward arrow, and at no point, although science was at some use along the way, since computer technology relies on science in most of its aspects, at no point did academic science serve in setting its direction. Rather, it served as a slave to chance discoveries in an opaque environment, with almost no one but college dropouts and overgrown high school students along the way. The process remained self-directed and unpredictable at every step, and the great fallacy is to make it sound irrational. The irrational resides in not seeing a free option when it is handed to us. China might be a quite convincing story, through the works of a genius observer, Joseph Needham, who debunked quite a bit of Western beliefs and figured out the powers of Chinese science. As China became a top-down mandarinate, that is, a state managed by Soviet Harvard centralized scribes, as Egypt had been before, the players somehow lost the zest for bricolage, the hunger for trial and error. Needham's biographer Simon Winchester cites the sinologist Mark Elvin's description of the problem, as the Chinese did not have, or rather no longer had, what he called the European mania for tinkering and improving. They had all the means to develop a spinning machine, but nobody tried. Another example of knowledge hampering optionality. They probably needed someone like Steve Jobs, blessed with an absence of college education and the right aggressiveness of temperament, to take the elements to their natural conclusion. As we will see in the next section, it is precisely this type of uninhibited doer who made the Industrial Revolution happen. We will next examine two cases. First, the Industrial Revolution, and second, medicine. So let us start by debunking a causal myth about the Industrial Revolution, the overstatement of the role of science in it. The Industrial Revolution. Knowledge formation, even when theoretical, takes time, some boredom, and the freedom that comes from having another occupation, therefore allowing one to escape the journalistic-style pressure of modern publish-and-perish academia to produce cosmetic knowledge, much like the counterfeit watches one buys in Chinatown in New York City, the type that you know is counterfeit, although it looks like the real thing. There were two main sources of technical knowledge and innovation in the 19th and early 20th centuries, the hobbyist and the English rector, both of whom were generally in barbell situations. An extraordinary proportion of work came out of the rector, the English parish priest with no worries, erudition, a large or at least comfortable house, domestic help, a reliable supply of tea and scones with clotted cream, and an abundance of free time. And, of course, optionality. The enlightened amateur, that is. The Reverend Thomas Bayes, as in Bayesian probability, and Thomas Malthus, Malthusian overpopulation, are the most famous. But there are many more surprises, cataloged in Bill Bryson's home, in which the author found 10 times more vicars and clergymen leaving recorded traces for posterity than scientists, physicists, economists, and even inventors. In addition to the previous 2 giants, I randomly list contributions by country clergymen. Reverend Edmund Cartwright invented the power loom, contributing to the Industrial Revolution. Reverend Jack Russell bred the terrier. Reverend William Buckland was the first authority on dinosaurs. Reverend William Greenwell invented modern archaeology. Reverend Octavius Pickard Cambridge was the foremost authority on spiders. Reverend George Garrett invented the submarine. Reverend Gilbert White was the most esteemed naturalist of his day. Reverend M.J. Barclay was the top expert on fungi. Reverend John Michel helped discover Uranus, and many more. Note that, just as with our episode documented with Haug, that organized science tends to skip the not made here, so the list of visible contribution by hobbyists and doers is most certainly shorter than the real one, as some academic might have appropriated the innovation by his predecessor. Let me get poetic for a moment. Self-directed scholarship has an aesthetic dimension. For a long time, I had on the wall of my study the following quote by Jacques Le Goff, the great French medievalist who believes that the Renaissance came out of independent humanists, not professional scholars. He examined the striking contrast in period paintings, drawings, and renditions that compare medieval university members and humanists. One is a professor surrounded and besieged by huddled students. The other is a solitary scholar, sitting in the tranquility and privacy of his chambers, at ease in the spacious and comfy room where his thoughts can move freely. Here we encounter the tumult of schools, the dust of classrooms, the indifference to beauty in collective workplaces. There it is all order and beauty, lux calm et volupte. As to the hobbyist in general, evidence shows him, along with the hungry adventurer and the private investor, to be at the source of the Industrial Revolution. Keeley, who we mentioned was not a historian and thankfully not an economist, in The Economic Laws of Scientific Research, questions the conventional linear model, that is, the belief that academic science leads to technology. For him, universities prospered as a consequence of national wealth, not the other way around. He even went further and claimed that, like naive interventions, these had iatrogenics that provided a negative contribution. He showed that in countries in which the government intervened by funding research with tax money, private investment decreased and moved away. For instance, in Japan, the almighty MITI, Ministry for Technology and Investment, has a horrible record of investment. I am not using his ideas to prop up a political program against science funding, only to debunk causal arrows in the discovery of important things. The Industrial Revolution, for a refresher, came from technologists building technology, or what he calls hobby science. Take again the steam engine, the one artifact that more than anything else embodies the Industrial Revolution. As we saw, we had a blueprint of how to build it from Hero of Alexandria. Yet, the theory didn't interest anyone for about 2 millennia. So practice and rediscovery had to be the cause of the interest in Hero's blueprint, not the other way around. Keeley presents a convincing, very convincing, argument that the steam engine emerged from pre-existing technology and was created by uneducated, often isolated men who applied practical common sense and intuition to address the mechanical problems that beset them, and whose solutions would yield obvious economic reward. Now, second, consider textile technologies. Again, the main technologies that led to the jump into the modern world owe, according to Keeley, nothing to science. In 1733, he writes, John Kay invented the flying shuttle, which mechanized weaving, and in 1770, James Hargreaves invented the spinning jenny, which, as its name implies, mechanized spinning. These major developments in textile technology, as well as those of Wyatt and Paul, spinning frame, 1758, Arkwright, water frame, 1769, presaged the Industrial Revolution. Yet they owed nothing to science. They were empirical developments based on the trial, error, and experimentation of skilled craftsmen who were trying to improve the productivity, and so the profits, of their factories. David Edgerton did some work questioning the link between academic science and economic prosperity, along with the idea that people believed in the linear model, that is, that academic science was at the source of technology, in the past. People were no suckers in the 19th and 20th century. We believe today that they believed in the said linear model then, but they did not. In fact, academics were mostly just teachers, not researchers, until well into the 20th century. Now, instead of looking into a scholar's writings to see whether he is credible or not, it is always best to consider what his detractors say. They will uncover what's worst in his argument. So I looked for the detractors of Keeley, or people opposing his ideas, to see if they address anything of merit, and to see where they come from. Aside from some comments by Joel Moker, who, as I said, has not yet discovered optionality, and an attack by an economist of the type who don't count, given the devaluation of the currency of the economics profession, the main critique against Keeley, published in the influential journal Nature by a science bureaucrat, was that he uses data from government-sponsored agencies, such as the OECD, in his argument against tax-funded research. So far, no substantive evidence that Keeley was wrong. But let us flip the burden of evidence. There is zero evidence that the opposite of his thesis is remotely right. Much of all of this is a religious belief in the unconditional power of organized science, one that has replaced unconditional religious belief in organized religion. Governments should spend on non-teleological tinkering, not research. Note that I do not believe that the argument set forth above should logically lead us to say that no money should be spent by government. This reasoning is more against teleology than research in general. There has to be a form of spending that works. By some vicious turn of events, governments have gotten huge payoffs from research, but not as intended. Just consider the Internet, and look at the recapture we've had of military expenditures with innovations, and, as we will see, medical cures. It is just that functionaries are too teleological in the way they look for things, particularly the Japanese, and so are large corporations. Most large corporations, such as Big Pharma, are their own enemies. Consider blue sky research, whereby research grants and funding are given to people, not projects, and spread in small amounts across many researchers. The sociologist of science, Steve Shapin, who spent time in California observing venture capitalists, reports that investors tend to back entrepreneurs, not ideas. Decisions are largely a matter of opinion, strengthened with who you know and who said what, as, to use the venture capitalist lingo, you bet on the jockey, not the horse. Why? Because innovations drift, and one needs flaneur-like abilities to keep capturing the opportunities that arise, not stay locked up in a bureaucratic mold. The significant venture capital decisions, Shapin showed, were made without real business plans. So if there was any analysis, it had to be of a backup, confirmatory nature. I myself spent some time with venture capitalists in California, with an eye on investing myself, and sure enough, that was the mold. Visibly, the money should go to the tinkerers, the aggressive tinkerers who you trust will milk the option. Let us use statistical arguments and get technical for a paragraph. Payoffs from research are from extremistan. They follow a power law type of statistical distribution with big, near unlimited upside, but, because of optionality, limited downside. Consequently, payoff from research should necessarily be linear to number of trials, not total funds involved in the trials. Since the winner will have an explosive payoff, uncapped, the right approach requires a certain style of blind funding. It means the right policy would be what is called the 1 divided by N, or 1 over N style, spreading attempts in as large a number of trials as possible. If you face N options, invest in all of them in equal amounts. Small amounts per trial, lots of trials, broader than you want. Why? Because in extremistan, it is more important to be in something in a small amount than to miss it. As one venture capitalist told me, the payoff can be so large that you can't afford not to be in everything. The case in medicine. Unlike technology, medicine has a long history of domestication of luck. It now has accepted randomness in its practice, but not quite. Medical data allow us to assess the performance of teleological research compared to randomly generated discoveries. The U.S. government provides us with the ideal data set for that, the activities of the National Cancer Institute that came out of the Nixon War on Cancer in the early 1970s. Morton Myers, a practicing doctor and researcher, writes in his wonderful Happy Accidents, Serendipity in Modern Medical Breakthroughs, "Over a 20-year period of screening, more than 144,000 plant extracts, representing about 15,000 species, not a single plant-based anti-cancer drug reached approved status. This failure stands in stark contrast to the discovery in the late 1950s of a major group of plant-derived cancer drugs, the vinca alkaloids, a discovery that came about by chance, not through directed research." John Lamatina, an insider who described what he saw after leaving the pharmaceutical business, shows statistics illustrating the gap between public perception of academic contributions and truth. Private industry develops 9 drugs out of 10. Even the tax-funded National Institutes of Health found that out of 46 drugs on the market with significant sales, about 3 had anything to do with federal funding. We have not digested the fact that cures for cancer had been coming from other branches of research. You search for non-cancer drugs, or non-cancer non-drugs, and find something you were not looking for, and vice versa. But the interesting constant is that when a result is initially discovered by an academic researcher, he is likely to disregard the consequences because it is not what he wanted to find. An academic has a script to follow. So, to put it in option terms, he does not exercise his option in spite of its value, a strict violation of rationality, no matter how you define rationality. Like someone who both is greedy and does not pick up a large sum of money found in his garden. Myers also shows the lecturing birds how to fly effect as discoveries are ex post narrated back to some academic research, contributing to our illusion. In some cases, because the source of the discovery is military, we don't know exactly what's going on. Take, for instance, chemotherapy for cancer, as discussed in Myers' book. An American ship carrying mustard gas off Bari in Italy was bombed by the Germans in 1942. It helped develop chemotherapy, owing to the effect of the gas on the condition of the soldiers who had liquid cancers, eradication of white blood cells. But mustard gas was banned by the Geneva Conventions, so the story was kept secret. Churchill purged all mention from UK records, and in the United States, the information was stifled, though not the research on the effect of nitrogen mustard. James Lefnew, the doctor and writer about medicine, wrote that the therapeutic revolution, or the period in the post-war years that saw a large number of effective therapies, was not ignited by a major scientific insight. It came from the exact opposite, the realization by doctors and scientists that it was not necessary to understand in any detail what was wrong, but that synthetic chemistry blindly and randomly would deliver the remedies that had eluded doctors for centuries. He uses as a central example the sulfonamides identified by Gerhard Domach. Further, the increase in our theoretical understanding, the epistemic base, to use Moker's term, came with a decrease in the number of new drugs. This is something Fat Tony or the Green Lumber Fellow could have told us. Now, one can argue that we depleted the low-hanging fruits, but I go further, with more cues from other parts, such as the payoff from the Human Genome Project, or the stalling of medical cures of the past 2 decades in the face of the growing research expenditures. Knowledge, or what is called knowledge, in complex domains, inhibits research. Or, another way to see it, studying the chemical composition of ingredients will make you neither a better cook nor a more expert taster. It might even make you worse at both. Cooking is particularly humbling for teleology-driven fellows. One can make a list of medications that came black swan style from serendipity and compare it to the list of medications that came from design. I was about to embark on such a list until I realized that the notable exceptions, that is, drugs that were discovered in a teleological manner, are too few, mostly AZT, AIDS drugs. Designer drugs have a main property. They are designed and are therefore teleological. but it does not look as if we are capable of designing a drug while taking into account the potential side effects. Hence a problem for the future of designer drugs. The more drugs there are on the market, the more interactions with one another. So we end up with a swelling number of possible interactions with every new drug introduced. If there are 20 unrelated drugs, the 21st would need to consider 20 interactions. No big deal. But if there are 1,000, we would need to predict a little less than 1,000. And there are tens of thousands of drugs available today. Further, there is research showing that we may be underestimating the interactions of current drugs, those already on the market, by a factor of 4. So, if anything, the pool of available drugs should be shrinking rather than growing. There is an obvious drift in that business, as a drug can be invented for something and find new applications. What the economist John Kay calls obliquity. Aspirin, for instance, changed many times in uses. Or the ideas of Judah Folkman about restricting the blood supply of tumors, angiogenesis inhibitors, have led to the treatment of macular degeneration, bevacizumab, known as Avastin, an effect that is more effective than the original intent. Now, instead of giving my laundry list of drugs here, too inelegant, I refer the reader to, in addition to Meyer's book, Claude Bouin and Claude Monnoret, Fabuleux Hasard, Histoire de la Découverte des Médicaments, and J. Jack Lee's Laughing Gas, Viagra and Lipitor. Matt Ridley's Anti-Teleological Argument. The great medieval Arabic language skeptic philosopher Al-Ghazal, a.k.a. Al-Ghazali, who tried to destroy the teleology of Averroes and his rationalism, came up with the famous metaphor of the pin, now falsely attributed to Adam Smith. The pin doesn't have a single maker, but 25 persons involved. These are all collaborating in the absence of a central planner, a collaboration guided by an invisible hand, for not a single one knows how to produce it on his own. In the eyes of Al-Ghazal, a skeptic fideist, that is, a skeptic with religious faith, knowledge was not in the hands of humans, but in those of God, while Adam Smith calls it the law of the market, and some modern theorist presents it as self-organization. If the listener wonders why fideism is epistemologically equivalent to pure skepticism about human knowledge and embracing the hidden logics of things, just replace God with nature, fate, the invisible, opaque and inaccessible, and you mostly get the same result. The logic of things stands outside of us, in the hands of God or natural or spontaneous forces, and given that nobody these days is in direct communication with God, even in Texas, there is little difference between God and opacity. Not a single individual has a clue about the general process, and that is central. The author Matt Ridley produces a more potent argument thanks to his background in biology. The difference between humans and animals lies in the ability to collaborate, engage in business, let ideas, pardon the expression, copulate. Collaboration has explosive upside, what is mathematically called a superadditive function, that is, 1 plus 1 equals more than 2, and 1 plus 1 plus 1 equals much, much more than 3. That is pure nonlinearity with explosive benefits. We will get into details on how it benefits from the Philosopher's Stone. Crucially, this is an argument for unpredictability and black swan effects. Since you cannot forecast collaborations and cannot direct them, you cannot see where the world is going. All you can do is create an environment that facilitates these collaborations and lay the foundation for prosperity. And no, you cannot centralize innovations. We tried that in Russia. Remarkably, to get a bit more philosophical with the ideas of Al-Ghazal, one can see religion's effect here in reducing dependence on the fallibility of human theories and agency. So Adam Smith meets Al-Ghazal in that sense. For one, the invisible hand is the market. For the other, it is God. It has been difficult for people to understand that, historically, skepticism has been mostly skepticism of expert knowledge rather than skepticism about abstract entities like God, and that all the great skeptics have been largely either religious or, at least, pro-religion, that is, in favor of others being religious. Corporate teleology. When I was in business school, I rarely attended lectures in something called strategic planning, a required course. And when I showed my face in class, I did not listen for a nanosecond to what was said there, did not even buy the books. There is something about the common sense of student culture. We knew that it was all babble. I passed the required classes in management by confusing the professors, playing with complicated logics, and I felt it intellectually dishonest to enroll in more classes than the strictly necessary. Corporations are in love with the idea of the strategic plan. They need to pay to figure out where they are going. Yet there is no evidence that strategic planning works. We even seem to have evidence against it. A management scholar, William Starbuck, has published a few papers debunking the effectiveness of planning. It makes the corporation option blind as it gets locked into a non-opportunistic course of action. Almost everything theoretical in management, from Taylorism to all productivity stories, upon empirical testing, has been exposed as pseudoscience, and like most economic theories, lives in a world parallel to the evidence. Matthew Stewart, who, trained as a philosopher, found himself in a management consultant job, gives a pretty revolting, if funny, inside story in The Management Myth. It is similar to the self-serving approach of bankers. Abrahamson and Friedman, in their beautiful book A Perfect Mess, also debunk many of these neat, crisp, teleological approaches. It turns out, strategic planning is just superstitious babble. For an illustration of business drift, rational and opportunistic business drift, take the following. Coca-Cola began as a pharmaceutical product. Tiffany & Company, the fancy jewelry store company, started life as a stationery store. The last two examples are close, perhaps, but consider next. Raytheon, which made the first missile guidance system, was a refrigerator maker. One of the founders was no other than Vannevar Bush, who conceived the teleological linear model of science we saw earlier. Go figure. Now, worse, Nokia, who used to be the top mobile phone maker, began as a paper mill. At some stage, they were into rubber shoes. DuPont, now famous for Teflon non-stick cooking pans, Corian countertops, and the durable fabric Kevlar, actually started out as an explosives company. Avon, the cosmetics company, started out in door-to-door book sales. And, the strangest of all, Oneida Silversmiths was a community religious cult, but for regulatory reasons they needed to use as cover a joint stock company. The inverse turkey problem. Now some plumbing behind what I am saying. Epistemology of statistical statements. The following discussion will show how the unknown, what you don't see, can contain good news in one case and bad news in another. And in extremistan territory, things get even more accentuated. To repeat, it is necessary to repeat because intellectuals tend to forget it, evidence of absence is not absence of evidence. A simple point that has the following implications. For the anti-fragile, good news tends to be absent from past data. And for the fragile, it is the bad news that doesn't show easily. Imagine going to Mexico with a notebook and trying to figure out the average wealth of the population from talking to people you randomly encounter. Odds are that, without Carlos Slim in your sample, you have little information. For out of the 100 or so million Mexicans, Slim would, I estimate, be richer than the bottom 70 to 90 million all taken together. So you may sample 50 million persons, and unless you include that rare event, you may have nothing in your sample and underestimate the total wealth. Remember the payoff from trial and error. When engaging in tinkering, you incur a lot of small losses, then once in a while you find something rather significant. Such methodology will show nasty attributes when seen from the outside. It hides its qualities, not its defects. In the anti-fragile case, of positive asymmetries, positive black swan businesses, such as trial and error, the sample track record will tend to underestimate the long-term average. It will hide the qualities, not the defects. Recall our mission to not be a turkey. The take-home is that, when facing a long sample subjected to turkey problems, one tends to estimate a lower number of adverse events. Simply, rare events are rare and tend not to show up in past samples, and given that the rare is almost always negative, we get a rosier picture than reality. But here we face the mirror image, the reverse situation. Under positive asymmetries, that is, the antifragile case, the unseen is positive. So empirical evidence tends to miss positive events and underestimate the total benefits. As to the classic turkey problem, the rule is as follows. In the fragile case of negative asymmetries, turkey problems, the sample track record will tend to underestimate the long-term average. It will hide the defects and display the qualities. The consequences make life simple. But since standard methodologies do not take asymmetries into account, about anyone who studied conventional statistics without getting very deep into the subject, just to theorize in social science or teach students, will get the turkey problem wrong. I have a simple rule that those who teach at Harvard should be expected to have much less understanding of things than cab drivers or people innocent of canned methods of inference. It is a heuristic. It can be wrong, but it works. It came to my attention as the Harvard Business School used to include fragilista Robert C. Merton on its staff. So let us pick on Harvard Business School professors, who deserve it quite a bit. When it comes to the first case, the error of ignoring positive asymmetries, one Harvard Business School professor, Gary Pisano, writing about the potential of biotech, made the elementary inverse turkey mistake, not realizing that in a business with limited losses and unlimited potential, the exact opposite of banking, what you don't see can be both significant and hidden from the past. He writes, "Despite the commercial success of several companies and the stunning growth in revenues for the industry as a whole, most biotechnology firms earn no profit." This may be correct, but the inference from it is wrong, possibly backward on two counts, and it helps to repeat the logic owing to the gravity of the consequences. First, most companies in extremistan make no profit. The rare event dominates, and a small number of companies generate all the shekels. And whatever point he may have, in the presence of asymmetry and optionality, it is inconclusive. So it is better to write about another subject, something less harmful that may interest Harvard students, like how to make a convincing PowerPoint presentation, or the difference in managerial cultures between the Japanese and the French. Again, he may be right about the pitiful potential of biotech investments, but not on the basis of the data he showed. Now, why is such thinking by the likes of Professor Pisano dangerous? It is not a matter of whether or not he would inhibit research in biotech. The problem is that such a mistake inhibits everything in economic life that has antifragile properties, more technically, right-skewed, and it would fragilize by favoring matters that are sure bets. Remarkably, another Harvard professor, Kenneth Fruit, made the exact same mistake, but in the opposite direction, with the negative asymmetries. Looking at reinsurance companies, those that insure catastrophic events, he thought that he found an aberration. They made too much profit given the risks they took, as catastrophes seemed to occur less often than what was reflected in the premia. He missed the point that catastrophic events hit them only negatively and tend to be absent from past data. Again, they are rare. Remember the turkey problem. One single episode, the asbestos liabilities, bankrupted families of Lloyd underwriters, losing income made over generations. One single episode. We will return to these two distinct payoffs with bounded left, limited losses like Thales Bet, and bounded right, limited gains, like insurance or banking. The distinction is crucial, as most payoffs in life fall in either one or the other category. To fail seven times, plus or minus two. Let me stop to issue rules based on the chapter so far. 1. Look for optionality. In fact, rank things according to optionality. 2. Preferably with open-ended, not closed-ended payoffs. 3. Do not invest in business plans, but in people. So look for someone capable of changing six or seven times over his career, or more. An idea that is part of the modus operandi of the venture capitalist Mark Andreessen. One gets immunity from the backfit narratives of the business plan by investing in people. It is simply more robust to do so. 4. Make sure you are barbelled, whatever that means in your business. The charlatan, the academic, and the showman. I end the chapter on a sad note, our ingratitude toward many who have helped us get here, letting our ancestors survive. Our misunderstanding of convex tinkering, anti-fragility, and how to tame randomness is woven into our institutions, though not consciously and explicitly. There is a category of people in medicine called the empirics, or empirical skeptics, the doers, and that is about it. We do not have many names for them, as they have not written a lot of books. Many of their works were destroyed or hidden from cultural consciousness, or have naturally dropped out of the archives, and their memory has been treated very badly by history. Formal thinkers and theorizing theorizers tend to write books. Seat-of-the-pants people tend to be practitioners who are often content to get the excitement, make or lose the money, and discourse at the pub. Their experiences are often formalized by academics. Indeed, history has been written by those who want you to believe that reasoning has a monopoly or near monopoly on the production of knowledge. So the final point here is about those called charlatans. Some were, others were less so. Some were not. And many were borderline. For a long time, official medicine had to compete with crowds of flashy showmen, mountebanks, quacks, sorcerers and sorceresses, and all manner of unlicensed practitioners. Some were itinerant, going from town to town carrying out their curative acts in front of large gatherings. They would perform surgery on occasion while repeating incantations. This category included doctors who did not subscribe to the dominant Greco-Arabic school of rational medicine, developed in the Hellenistic world of Asia Minor and later grown by the Arabic language school. The Romans were an anti-theoretical, pragmatic bunch. The Arabs loved everything philosophical and scientific, and put Aristotle, about whom nobody seemed to have cared much until then, on a pedestal. For instance, we know very, very little of the skeptical empirical school of Monodotus of Nicomedia. We know a lot more about Galen, the rationalist. Medicine, for the Arabs, was a scholarly pursuit and founded on the logic of Aristotle and the methods of Galen. They abhorred experience. Medical practitioners were the other. It is not very well noticed that Arabic thought favors abstract thinking and science in the most theoretical sense of the word, violently rationalistic, away from empiricism. The regulation of the medical establishment corresponds to worries about the empirics for economic reasons, as competition made their incomes drop. So no wonder these were bundled with the thieves, to wit this long title for an Elizabethan treatise, a short discourse or discovery of certain stratagems whereby our London empirics have been observed strongly to oppugn and oft-times to expugn their poor patients' purses. Charlatan was held to be a synonym for empiric. The word empiric designated someone who relied on experiment and experience to ascertain what was correct. In other words, trial and error and tinkering. That was held to be inferior, professionally, socially, and intellectually. It is still not considered to be very intelligent. But, luckily for us, the empirics enjoyed immense popular support and could not be uprooted. You do not see their works, but they left a huge imprint on medicine. Note the initial peaking of iatrogenics after the academization and institutionalization of medicine with the onset of modernity. It has only recently started to reverse. Also, formal academics, seen in the light of history, were not better than those they called charlatans. They just hid their fraud under the weight of more convincing rationalizations. They were just organized quacks. My hope is for that to change. Now, I agree that most non-academically vetted medical practitioners were scoundrels, mountebanks, quacks, and often even worse than these. But let's hold off jumping to the wrong conclusions. Formalists, to protect their turf, have always played on the logical fallacy that if quacks are found among non-academics, non-academics are all quacks. They keep doing it. The statement, "all that is non-rigorous is non-academic," assuming one is a sucker and believes it, does not imply that all that is non-academic is non-rigorous. The fight between the legitimate doctors and the others is quite enlightening, particularly when you note that doctors were silently and reluctantly copying some of the remedies and cures developed and promoted by the others. They had to do so for economic reasons. They benefited from the collective trial and error of the others. and the process led to cures, now integrated into medicine. Now, listener, let us take a minute and pay some respect. Consider our ingratitude to those who got us here, got our disrespect, and do not even know that they were heroes. Chapter 16. How to Deal with Soccer Moms, The Education of a Flaneur. A Lesson in Disorder. Where is the next street fight? How to decommoditize, deterristify? The intelligent student, also in reverse, flaneur as options. Let us continue with teleology and disorder, in private life and individual education, then an autobiographical vignette. The ecological and the ludic. As we saw with the fellow making the common but false analogy to blackjack in Chapter 7, there are two domains, the ludic, which is set up like a game, with its rules supplied in advance in an explicit way, and the ecological, where we don't know the rules and cannot isolate variables, as in real life. Seeing the non-transferability of skills from one domain to the other led me to skepticism in general about whatever skills are acquired in a classroom, anything in a non-ecological way, as compared to street fights and real-life situations. It is not well advertised that there is no evidence that abilities in chess lead to better reasoning off the chessboard. Even those who play blind chess games with an entire cohort can't remember things outside the board better than a regular person. We accept the domain specificity of games, the fact that they do not really train you for life, that there are severe losses in translation. But we find it hard to apply this lesson to technical skills acquired in schools, that is, to accept the crucial fact that what is picked up in the classroom stays largely in the classroom. Worse even, the classroom can bring some detectable harm, a measure of iatrogenics hardly ever discussed. Laura Martignon showed me results from her doctoral student Birgit Ulmer, demonstrating that children's ability to count degrades right after they are taught arithmetic. When you ask children how many intervals there are between 15 poles, those who don't know arithmetic figure out that there are 14 of them. Those who studied arithmetic get confused and often make the mistake that there are 15. The Touristification of the Soccer Mom. The biologist and intellectual E.O. Wilson was once asked what represented the most hindrance to the development of children. His answer was the soccer mom. He did not use the notion of the Procrustean bed, but he outlined it perfectly. His argument is that they repress children's natural biophilia, their love of living things. But the problem is more general. Soccer moms try to eliminate the trial and error, the anti-fragility, from children's lives, move them away from the ecological, and transform them into nerds working on pre-existing, soccer mom-compatible, maps of reality. Good students, but nerds. That is, they are like computers except slower. Further, they are now totally untrained to handle ambiguity. As a child of Civil War, I disbelieve in structured learning. Actually, I believe that one can be an intellectual without being a nerd, provided one has a private library instead of a classroom, and spends time as an aimless but rational flaneur, benefiting from what randomness can give us inside and outside the library. Provided we have the right type of rigor, we need randomness, mess, adventures, uncertainty, self-discovery, near-traumatic episodes, all these things that make life worth living, compared to the structured, fake, and ineffective life of an empty-suit CEO with a preset schedule and an alarm clock. Even their leisure is subjected to a clock, squash between 4 and 5, as their life is sandwiched between appointments. It is as if the mission of modernity was to squeeze every drop of variability and randomness out of life, with, as we saw in Chapter 5, the ironic result of making the world a lot more unpredictable, as if the goddesses of chance wanted to have the last word. Only the autodidacts are free, and not just in school matters, those who decommoditize, detouristify their lives. Sports try to put randomness in a box, like the one sold in aisle 6 next to canned tuna, a form of alienation. If you want to understand how vapid are the current modernistic arguments and understand your existential priorities, consider the difference between lions in the wild and those in captivity. Lions in captivity live longer. They are technically richer, and they are guaranteed job security for life, if these are the criteria you are focusing on. As usual, an ancient, here Seneca, detected the problem and the difference with his saying, "We do not study for life, but only for the lecture room." Non vitae sed scolae discimus, which to my great horror has been corrupted and self-servingly changed to fit the motto of many colleges in the United States, with non scolae sed vitae discimus as their motto, meaning that we study here for life, not for the lecture hall. Most of the tension in life will take place when the one who reduces and fragilizes, say the policymaker, invokes rationality. An anti-fragile barbell education. Something cured me of the effect of education and made me very skeptical of the very notion of standardized learning. For I am a pure autodidact, in spite of acquiring degrees. My father was known in Lebanon as the intelligent student, student intelligent, a play on words as the Arabic phrase for intelligent student or scholar is Taleb Naguib, and his name was Naguib Taleb. That was the way the newspaper published his name for having the highest grade on the Lebanese high school exit exam. He was a national valedictorian of sorts, and the main newspaper announced his passing in 2002 with a front-page headline with a pun on his predestined name, "The intelligent student, student intelligent, is no longer." His school education was harrowing, though, as he attended the elite Jesuit school. The Jesuits' mission was to produce the mandarins who ran the place by filtering and filtering students after every year. They were successful beyond their aim, as in addition to having one of the highest success rates in the world in the French baccalaureate, in spite of the war, their school had a world-class roster of former students. The Jesuits also deprived pupils of free time, so many gave up voluntarily. So one can surmise that having a father as national valedictorian would definitely have provided me with a cure against school, and it did. My father himself did not seem to overvalue school education, since he did not put me in the Jesuit school to spare me what he went through. But this clearly left me to seek ego fulfillment elsewhere. Observing my father close up made me realize what being a valedictorian meant, what being an intelligent student meant, mostly in the negative. They were things that intelligent students were unable to understand. Some blindness came with the package. This idea followed me for a long time, as when I worked in trading rooms, where you sit most of the time waiting for things to happen, a situation similar to that of people sitting in bars or mafia men hanging around. I figured out how to select people on their ability to integrate socially with others while sitting around doing nothing, and enjoy fuzziness. You select people on their ability to hang around as a filter, and studious people were not good at hanging around. They needed to have a clear task. When I was about 10, I realized that good grades weren't as good outside school as they were in it, and they carried some side effects. They had to correspond to a sacrifice, an intellectual sacrifice of sorts. Actually, my father kept hinting to me the problem of getting good grades himself. The person who was at the exact bottom of his class, and ironically, the father of a classmate at Wharton, turned out to be a self-made merchant, by far the most successful person in his class. He had a huge yacht with his initials prominently displayed on it. Another one made a killing buying wood in Africa, retired before 40, then became an amateur historian, mostly in ancient Mediterranean history, and entered politics. In a way, my father did not seem to value education, rather culture or money, and he prompted me to go for these two. I initially went for culture. He had a total fascination with erudites and businessmen, people whose position did not depend on credentials. My idea was to be rigorous in the open market. This made me focus on what an intelligent anti-student needed to be, an autodidact or a person of knowledge compared to the students called swallowers in Lebanese dialect, those who swallow school material, and whose knowledge is only derived from the curriculum. The edge, I realized, isn't in the package of what was on the official program of the baccalaureate, which everyone knew with small variations multiplying into large discrepancies in grades, but exactly what lay outside it. Some can be more intelligent than others in a structured environment. In fact, school has a selection bias as it favors those quicker in such an environment, and like anything competitive, at the expense of performance outside it. Although I was not yet familiar with gyms, my idea of knowledge was as follows. People who build their strength using these modern expensive gym machines can lift extremely large weights, show great numbers, and develop impressive-looking muscles, but fail to lift a stone. They get completely hammered in a street fight by someone trained in more disorderly settings. Their strength is extremely domain-specific, and their domain doesn't exist outside of ludic, extremely organized constructs. In fact, their strength, as with over-specialized athletes, is the result of a deformity. I thought it was the same with people who were selected for trying to get high grades in a small number of subjects, rather than follow their curiosity. Try taking them slightly away from what they studied and watch their decomposition, loss of confidence, and denial. Just like corporate executives are selected for their ability to put up with the boredom of meetings, many of these people were selected for their ability to concentrate on boring material. I've debated many economists who claim to specialize in risk and probability. When one takes them slightly outside their narrow focus, but within the discipline of probability, they fall apart, with the disconsolate face of a gym rat in front of a gangster hitman. Again, I wasn't exactly an autodidact, since I did get degrees. I was rather a barbell autodidact, as I studied the exact minimum necessary to pass any exam, overshooting accidentally once in a while, and only getting in trouble a few times by undershooting. But I read voraciously, wholesale, initially in the humanities, later in mathematics and science, and now in history, outside a curriculum, away from the gym machine, so to speak. I figured out that whatever I selected myself, I could read with more depth and more breadth. There was a match to my curiosity, and I could take advantage of what people later pathologized as attention deficit hyperactive disorder, ADHD, by using natural stimulation as a main driver to scholarship. The enterprise needed to be totally effortless in order to be worthwhile. The minute I was bored with a book or a subject, I moved to another one, instead of giving up on reading altogether. When you are limited to the school material and you get bored, you have a tendency to give up and do nothing or play hooky out of discouragement. The trick is to be bored with a specific book, rather than with the act of reading. So the number of pages absorbed could grow faster than otherwise. And you find gold, so to speak, effortlessly, just as in rational but undirected trial-and-error-based research. It is exactly like options, trial-and-error, not getting stuck, bifurcating when necessary, but keeping a sense of broad freedom and opportunism. Trial-and-error is freedom. I confess I still use that method at the time of this writing. Avoidance of boredom is the only worthy mode of action. Life otherwise is not worth living. My parents had an account with the largest bookstore in Beirut, and I would pick up books in what seemed to me unlimited quantities. There was such a difference between the shelves of the library and the narrow school material. So I realized that school was a plot designed to deprive people of erudition by squeezing their knowledge into a narrow set of authors. I started, around the age of 13, to keep a log of my reading hours, shooting for between 30 and 60 a week, a practice I've kept up for a long time. I read the likes of Dostoevsky, Turgenev, Chekhov, Bishop Bossuet, Stendhal, Dante, Proust, Borges, Calvino, Céline, Schultz, Zweig, didn't like, Henry Miller, Max Brod, Kafka, Ionesco, the Surrealists, Faulkner, Malraux, along with other wild adventurers such as Conrad and Melville. The first book I read in English was Moby Dick, and similar authors in literature, many of them obscure, and Hegel, Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, Marx, Jaspers, Husserl, Levi Strauss, Levinas, Scholem, Benjamin, and similar ones in philosophy, because they had the golden status of not being on the school program. And I managed to read nothing that was prescribed by school, so to this day I haven't read Racine, Corneille, and other bores. One summer I decided to read the 20 novels by Emile Zola in 20 days, one a day, and managed to do so at great expense. Perhaps joining an underground anti-government group motivated me to look into Marxist studies, and I picked up the most about Hegel indirectly, mostly through Alexandra Kojève. When I decided to come to the United States, I repeated, around the age of 18, the marathon exercise by buying a few hundred books in English by authors ranging from Trollope to Burke, Macaulay and Gibbon, with Anaïs Nin and other then-fashionable authors de scandale, not showing up to class and keeping the 30 to 60 hour discipline. In school, I had figured out that when one could write essays with a rich, literary but precise vocabulary, though not inadequate to the topic at hand, and maintain some coherence throughout, what one writes about becomes secondary, and the examiners get a hint about one's style and rigor from that. And my father gave me a complete break after I got published as a teenager in a local paper. Just don't flunk, was his condition. It was a barbell. Play it safe at school and read on your own. Have zero expectation from school. Later, after I was jailed for assaulting a policeman in a student riot, he acted scared of me and let me do whatever I wanted. When I reached the "f*** you money" stage in my 20s, at the time when it was much, much rarer than today, in spite of a war raging in the home country, my father took credit for it by attributing it to the breadth of the education he allowed me to have and how it differentiated me from others like him with narrow background. When, at Wharton, I discovered that I wanted to specialize in a profession linked to probability and rare events, a probability and randomness obsession took control of my mind. I also smelled some flaws with statistical stuff that the professor could not explain, brushing them away. It was what the professor was brushing away that had to be the meat. I realized that there was a fraud somewhere, that Six Sigma events, measures of very rare events, were grossly miscomputed, and we had no basis for their computation. But I could not articulate my realization clearly, and was getting humiliated by people who started smoking me with complicated math. I saw the limits of probability in front of me, clear as crystal, but could not find the words to express the point. So I went to the bookstore and ordered, there was no web at the time, almost every book with probability or stochastic in its title. I read nothing else for a couple of years. No course material, no newspaper, no literature, nothing. I read them in bed, jumping from one book to the next when stuck with something I did not get immediately or felt ever so slightly bored. And I kept ordering those books. I was hungry to go deeper into the problem of small probabilities. It was effortless. That was my best investment. Risk turned out to be the topic I know the best. 5 years later, I was set for life, and now I am making a research career out of various aspects of small probability events. Had I studied the subject by prepackaged means, I would now be brainwashed into thinking that uncertainty was something to be found in a casino, that kind of thing. There is such a thing as non-nerdy applied mathematics. Find a problem first, and figure out the math that works for it, just as one acquires language, rather than study in a vacuum through theorems and artificial examples, then change reality to make it look like these examples. One day in the 1980s, I had dinner with a famous speculator, a hugely successful man. He muttered the hyperbole that hit home, "Much of what other people know isn't worth knowing." To this day, I still have the instinct that the treasure, what one needs to know for a profession, is necessarily what lies outside the corpus, as far away from the center as possible. But there is something central in following one's own direction in the selection of readings. What I was given to study in school, I have forgotten. What I decided to read on my own, I still remember. Chapter 17. Fat Tony Argues with Socrates. Why can't we do things we can't explain, and why do we have to explain things we do? The Dionysian, the sucker-non-sucker approach to things. Fat Tony debates Socrates. Piety for the impious. Fat Tony does not drink milk. Always ask poets to explain their poetry. Mystagog Philosophaster. Fat Tony believes that they were totally justified in putting Socrates to death. This chapter will allow us to complete the discussion of the difference between narrated, intelligible knowledge and the more opaque kind that is entirely probed by tinkering, the two columns of Table 4 separating narrative and non-narrative action. There is this error of thinking that things always have a reason that is accessible to us, that we can comprehend easily. Indeed, the most severe mistake made in life is to mistake the unintelligible for the unintelligent, something Nietzsche figured out. In a way, it resembles the turkey problem, mistaking what we don't see for the non-existent, a sibling to mistaking absence of evidence for evidence of absence. We've been falling for the green lumber problem since the beginning of the golden age of philosophy. We saw Aristotle mistaking the source of Thales' success. Now we turn to Socrates, the greatest of the great masters. Euthyphro. Plato expressed himself chiefly through his use of the person who no doubt became the most influential philosopher in history, Socrates the Athenian, the first philosopher in the modern sense. Socrates left no writing of his own, so we get direct representation of him mainly through Plato and Xenophon. And just as Fat Tony has, as his self-appointed biographer, yours truly, trying to satisfy his own agenda, leading to distortions in his character and self-serving representation of some of the said author's ideas, so I am certain that the Socrates of Plato is a more Platonic character than the true Socrates. The other biographer of Socrates, Xenophon, presents a different picture. The Socrates of the Memorabilia is no-nonsense and down-to-earth. He despises sterile knowledge and the experts who study matters without practical consequence when so many useful and important things are neglected. Instead of looking at stars to understand causes, figure out how you can use them to navigate. Use geometry to measure land, but no more. In one of Plato's dialogues, Euthyphro, Socrates was outside the courthouse, awaiting the trial in which he was eventually put to death, when the eponymous Euthyphro, a religious expert and prophet of sorts, struck up a conversation with him. Socrates started explaining that for the activities with which he was charged by the court, corrupting the youth and introducing new gods at the expense of the older ones, not only he did not charge a fee, but he was in perfect readiness to pay for people to listen to him. It turned out that Euthyphro was on his way to charge his father with manslaughter, not a bad conversation starter. So Socrates started out by wondering how charging his own father with manslaughter was compatible with Euthyphro's religious duties. Socrates' technique was to make his interlocutor, who started with a thesis, agree to a series of statements, then proceed to show him how the statements he agreed to are inconsistent with the original thesis, thus establishing that he has no clue as to what he was talking about. Socrates used it mostly to show people how lacking in clarity they were in their thoughts, how little they knew about the concepts they used routinely, and the need for philosophy to elucidate these concepts. In the beginning of the Euthyphro dialogue, he catches his interlocutor using the word piety, characterizing the prosecution of his father as a pious act, and so giving the impression that he was conducting the prosecution on grounds of piety. But he could not come up with a definition that suited Socrates. Socrates kept pestering the poor fellow, as he could not produce a definition of piety. The dialogue continued with more definitions. What is moral rectitude? Until Euthyphro found some polite excuse to run away. The dialogue ended abruptly, but the reader is left with the impression that it could have gone on until today, 25 centuries later, without it bringing us any closer to anything. Let us reopen it. Fat Tony versus Socrates. How would Fat Tony have handled the cross-examination by the relentless Athenian? Now that the reader is acquainted with our hefty character, let us examine, as a thought experiment, an equivalent dialogue between Fat Tony and Socrates, properly translated, of course. Clearly there are similarities between the two characters. Both had time on their hands and enjoyed unlimited leisure, though, in Tony's case, free time was the result of productive insights. Both like to argue, and both look at active conversation, instead of TV screen or concert hall passivity, as a main source of entertainment. Both dislike writing. Socrates because he did not like the definitive and immutable character that is associated with the written word, when for him answers are never final and should not be fixed. Nothing should be written in stone, even literally. Socrates in the Euthyphro boasts for ancestry the sculptor Daedalus, whose statues came alive as soon as the work was completed. When you talk to one of Daedalus's statues, it talks back to you, unlike the ones you see in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. Tony, for his part, did not like writing for other, no less respectable reasons. He almost flunked out of high school in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. But the similarity stopped somewhere, which would be good enough for a dialogue. Of course, we can expect a bit of surprise on the part of Fat Tony, standing in front of the man described to him by Nero as the greatest philosopher of all time. Socrates, we are told, had looks beyond unprepossessing. Socrates was repeatedly described as having a protruding belly, thin limbs, bulging eyes, a snub nose. He looked haggard. He might even have had body odor, as he was said to bathe much less than his peers. You can imagine Fat Tony sneering while pointing his finger at the fellow. "Look, Nero, you want me to talk to this?" Or perhaps not. Socrates was said to have a presence, a certain personal confidence and a serenity of mind that made some young men find him beautiful. What Nero was certain of was that Fat Tony would initially get close to Socrates and form his opinion on the fellow after some olfactory investigation. And as we said, Fat Tony doesn't even realize that this is part of his modus operandi. Now, assume Fat Tony was asked by Socrates how he defined piety. Fat Tony's answer would have been most certainly to get lost. Fat Tony, aware of Socrates' statement that not only would he debate for free, but he would be ready to pay for conversation, would have claimed one doesn't argue with someone who is ready to pay you to argue with him. But Fat Tony's power in life is that he never lets the other person frame the question. He taught Nero that an answer is planted in every question. Never respond with a straight answer to a question that makes no sense to you. Fat Tony, you are asking me to define what characteristic makes a difference between pious and non-pious. Do I really need to be able to tell you what it is to be able to conduct a pious action? Socrates, how can you use a word like piety without knowing what it means, while pretending to know what it means? Fat Tony, do I actually have to be able to tell you in plain barbarian non-Greek English or in pure Greek what it means to prove that I know and understand what it means? I don't know it in words, but I know what it is. No doubt Fat Tony would have taken Socrates of Athens further down his own road and be the one doing the framing of the question. Fat Tony, tell me, old man, does a child need to define mother's milk to understand the need to drink it? Socrates, no, he does not need to. Fat Tony, using the same repetitive pattern of Socrates in the Plato dialogues. And my dear Socrates, does a dog need to define what an owner is to be loyal to him? Socrates, puzzled to have someone ask him questions. A dog has instinct. It does not reflect on its life. He doesn't examine his life. We are not dogs. Fat Tony, I agree, my dear Socrates, that a dog has instinct and that we are not dogs. But are we humans so fundamentally different as to be completely stripped of instinct, leading us to do things we have no clue about? Do we have to limit life to what we can answer in proto-Brooklyn English? Without waiting for Socrates' answer, only suckers wait for answers, questions are not made for answers. Fat Tony, then my good Socrates, why do you think that we need to fix the meaning of things? Socrates, my dear Megatony, we need to know what we are talking about when we talk about things. The entire idea of philosophy is to be able to reflect and understand what we are doing, examine our lives. An unexamined life is not worth living. Fat Tony, the problem, my poor old Greek, is that you are killing the things we can know but not express. And if I asked someone riding a bicycle just fine to give me the theory behind his bicycle riding, he would fall from it. By bullying and questioning people, you confuse them and hurt them. Then, looking at him patronizingly, with a smirk, very calmly, Fat Tony, my dear Socrates, you know why they are putting you to death? It is because you make people feel stupid for blindly following habits, instincts, and traditions. You may be occasionally right, but you may confuse them about things they've been doing just fine without getting in trouble. You are destroying people's illusions about themselves. You are taking the joy of ignorance out of the things we don't understand, and you have no answer. You have no answer to offer them. Primacy of definitional knowledge. You can see that what Fat Tony is hitting here is the very core of philosophy. It is indeed with Socrates that the main questions that became philosophy today were first raised. Questions such as, what is existence? What are morals? What is a proof? What is science? What is this? And what is that? The question we saw in Euthyphro pervades the various dialogues written by Plato. What Socrates is seeking relentlessly are definitions of the essential nature of the thing concerned, rather than descriptions of the properties by means of which we can recognize them. Socrates went even as far as questioning the poets and reported that they had no more clue than the public about their own works. In Plato's account of his trial in the Apology, Socrates recounted how he cross-examined the poets in vain. I took them some of the most elaborate passages in their own writings and asked what was the meaning of them. I am almost ashamed to speak of this, but still I must say that there is hardly a person present who wouldn't have talked better about their poetry than they did themselves. And this priority of definitional knowledge led to Plato's thesis that you cannot know anything unless you know the forms, which are what definitions specify. If we cannot define piety from working with particulars, then let us start with the universals from which these particulars should flow. In other words, if you cannot get a map from a territory, build a territory out of the map. In defense of Socrates, his questions lead to a major result. If they could not allow him to define what something was, at least they allowed him to be certain about what a thing was not. Mistaking the unintelligible for the unintelligent. Fat Tony, of course, had many precursors. Many we will not hear about because of the primacy of philosophy and the way it got integrated into daily practices by Christianity and Islam. By philosophy, I mean theoretical and conceptual knowledge, all knowledge, things we can write down. For, until recently, the term largely referred to what we call today science. Natural philosophy, this attempt to rationalize nature, penetrate her logic. A vivid modern attack on the point came from the young Friedrich Nietzsche. Though dressed up in literary flights on optimism and pessimism, mixed with a hallucination on what West, a typical Hellene, and the German soul mean. The young Nietzsche wrote his first book, The Birth of Tragedy, while in his early 20s. He went after Socrates, whom he called the mystagogue of science, for making existence appear comprehensible. This brilliant passage exposes what I call the sucker-rationalistic fallacy. Perhaps thus he, Socrates, should have asked himself, what is not intelligible to me is not necessarily unintelligent? Perhaps there is a realm of wisdom from which the logician is exiled? What is not intelligible to me is not necessarily unintelligent, is perhaps the most potent sentence in all of Nietzsche's century, and we used a version of it in the prologue, in the very definition of the fragilista who mistakes what he does not understand for nonsense. Nietzsche is also allergic to Socrates' version of truth, largely motivated by the agenda of the promotion of understanding, since, according to Socrates, one does not knowingly do evil. An argument that seems to have pervaded the Enlightenment, as such thinkers as Condorcet made truth the only and sufficient source for the good. This argument is precisely what Nietzsche vituperated against. Knowledge is the panacea. Error is evil. Hence, science is an optimistic enterprise. The mandate of scientific optimism irritated Nietzsche. This use of reasoning and knowledge in the service of utopia. Forget the optimism-pessimism business that is addressed when people discuss Nietzsche, as the so-called Nietzschean pessimism distracts from the point. It is the very goodness of knowledge that he questioned. It took me a long time to figure out the central problem that Nietzsche addressed in The Birth of Tragedy. He sees two forces, the Apollonian and the Dionysian. One is measured, balanced, rational, imbued with reason and self-restraint. The other is dark, visceral, wild, untamed, hard to understand, emerging from the inner layers of ourselves. Ancient Greek culture represented a balance of the two, until the influence of Socrates on Euripides gave a larger share to the Apollonian and disrupted the Dionysian, causing this excessive rise of rationalism. It is equivalent to disrupting the natural chemistry of your body by the injection of hormones. The Apollonian without the Dionysian is, as the Chinese would say, yang without yin. Nietzsche's potency as a thinker continues to surprise me. He figured out anti-fragility. While many attribute mistakenly the notion of creative destruction to the economist Joseph Schumpeter, not wondering how something insightful and deep can come out of an economist, while, as we saw, the more erudite source it to Karl Marx, it is indeed Nietzsche who was first to coin the term with reference to Dionysus, whom he called creatively destructive and destructively creative. Nietzsche indeed figured out, in his own way, anti-fragility. Adam Smith was first and last a moral philosopher. Marx was a philosopher. Kahneman and Simon are psychologists and cognitive scientists, respectively. The exception is, of course, Hayek. I read Nietzsche's The Birth of Tragedy twice, first as a child when I was very green. The second time, after a life thinking of randomness, it hit me that Nietzsche understood something that I did not find explicitly stated in his work, that growth in knowledge, or in anything, cannot proceed without the Dionysian. It reveals matters that we can select at some point, given that we have optionality. In other words, it can be the source of stochastic tinkering, and the Apollonian can be part of the rationality in the selection process. Let me bring the big boss, Seneca, into the picture. He, too, referred to Dionysian and Apollonian attributes. He appeared to present, in one of his writings, a richer version of our human tendencies. Talking about a god, whom he also calls destiny, equating him with the interaction of causes, he gives him three manifestations. First, the liber pater, the bacchic force, that is, the Dionysus to whom Nietzsche referred, that gives seminal power to the continuation of life. Second, Hercules, who embodies strength. And third, Mercury, who represented, for Seneca's contemporaries, craft, science, and reason, what for Nietzsche appeared to be the Apollonian. Richer than Nietzsche, he included strength as an additional dimension. As I said, earlier attacks on philosophy, in the sense of rationalistic knowledge from the Plato and Aristotle traditions, came from a variety of people, not necessarily visible in the corpus, mostly in forgotten or rarely mentioned texts. Why forgotten? Because structured learning likes the impoverishment and simplification of naive rationalism, easy to teach, not the rich texture of empiricism. And, as I said, those who attacked academic thinking had little representation, something that we will see is starkly apparent in the history of medicine. An even more accomplished and far more open-minded classical scholar than Nietzsche, the 19th-century French thinker Ernest Renan knew, in addition to the usual Greek and Latin, Hebrew, Aramaic, Syriac, and Arabic. In his attack on Averroes, he expressed the famous idea that logic excludes, by definition, nuances, and since truth resides exclusively in the nuances, it is a useless instrument for finding truth in the moral and political sciences. Tradition. As Fat Tony said, Socrates was put to death because he disrupted something that, in the eyes of the Athenian establishment, was working just fine. Things are too complicated to be expressed in words. By doing so, you kill humans. Or people, as with the green lumber, may be focusing on the right things, but we are not good enough to figure it out intellectually. Death and martyrdom make good marketing, particularly when one faces destiny while unwavering in his opinions. A hero is someone imbued with intellectual confidence and ego, and death is something too small for him. While most of the accounts we hear of Socrates make him heroic, Thanks to his death and his resignation to die in a philosophical way, he had some classical critics who believed that Socrates was destroying the foundations of society, the heuristics that are transmitted by the elders and that we may not be mature enough to question. Cato the Elder, whom we met in Chapter 2, was highly allergic to Socrates. Cato had the bottom-line mind of Fat Tony, but with a much higher civic sense of mission, respect for tradition, and commitment to moral rectitude. He was also allergic to things Greek, as exhibited in his allergy to philosophers and doctors, an allergy which, as we will see in later chapters, had remarkably modern justifications. Cato's commitment to democracy led him to believe in both freedom and the rules of custom, in combination with fear of tyranny. Plutarch quotes him as saying, "Socrates was a mighty babbler who tried to make himself tyrant of his country in order to destroy its customs and entice its citizens into holding views contrary to law and order." So the listener can see how the ancients saw naive rationalism. By impoverishing rather than enhancing thought, it introduces fragility. They knew that incompleteness, half-knowledge, is always dangerous. Many other people than the ancients have been involved in defending and inviting us to respect this different type of knowledge. First, Edmund Burke, the Irish statesman and political philosopher, who also countered the French Revolution for disrupting the collected reasons of the ages. He believed that large social variations can expose us to unseen effects, and thus advocated the notion of small trial-and-error experiments, in effect convex tinkering, in social systems, coupled with respect for the complex heuristics of tradition. Also, Michael Oakeshott, the 20th-century conservative political philosopher and philosopher of history, who believed that traditions provide an aggregation of filtered collective knowledge. Another one in that league would be Joseph de Maistre, who, as we saw, thought in second steps. He was a French-language royalist and counter-Enlightenment thinker who was vocal against the ills of the Revolution and believed in the fundamental depravity of men, unless checked by some dictatorship. Clearly, Wittgenstein would be at the top of the list of modern anti-fragile thinkers, with his remarkable insight into the inexpressible with words. And of all thinkers, he best understands the green lumber issue. He may be the first ever to express a version of it when he doubted the ability of language to express the literal. In addition, the fellow was a saint. He sacrificed his life, his friendships, his fortune, his reputation, everything for the sake of philosophy. We may be drawn to think that Friedrich Hayek would be in that anti-fragile, anti-rationalist category. He is the 20th century philosopher and economist who opposed social planning on the grounds that the pricing system reveals through transactions the knowledge embedded in society, knowledge not accessible to a social planner. But Hayek missed the notion of optionality as a substitute for the social planner. In a way, he believed in intelligence, but as a distributed or collective intelligence, not in optionality as a replacement for intelligence. The anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss showed that non-literate peoples had their own science of the concrete, a holistic way of thinking about their environment in terms of objects and their secondary, sensuous qualities, which was not necessarily less coherent than many of our scientific approaches, and, in many respects, can be as rich as and even richer than ours. Again, green lumber. Finally, John Gray, the contemporary political philosopher and essayist who stands against human hubris and has been fighting the prevailing ideas that the Enlightenment is a panacea, treating a certain category of thinkers as Enlightenment fundamentalists. Gray showed repeatedly how what we call scientific progress can be just a mirage. When he, myself, and the essayist Brian Appleyard got together for lunch, I was mentally prepared to discuss ideas and advocate my own. I was pleasantly surprised by what turned out the best lunch I ever had in my entire life. There was this smoothness of knowing that the three of us tacitly understood the same point and, instead, went to the second step of discussing applications, something as mundane as replacing our currency holdings with precious metals, as these are not owned by governments. Gray worked in an office next to Hayek and told me that Hayek was quite a dull fellow, lacking playfulness, hence optionality. The sucker-non-sucker distinction. Let us introduce the Philosopher's Stone back into this conversation. Socrates is about knowledge, not Fat Tony, who has no idea what it is. For Tony, the distinction in life isn't true or false, but rather sucker or non-sucker. Things are always simpler with him. In real life, as we saw with the ideas of Seneca and the bets of Thales, exposure is more important than knowledge. Decision effects supersede logic. Textbook knowledge misses a dimension, the hidden asymmetry of benefits, just like the notion of average. The need to focus on the payoff from your actions instead of studying the structure of the world or understanding the true and the false has been largely missed in intellectual history. Horribly missed. The payoff, what happens to you, the benefits or harm from it, is always the most important thing, not the event itself. Philosophers talk about truth and falsehood. People in life talk about payoff, exposure, and consequences, risks and rewards, hence fragility and anti-fragility. And sometimes philosophers and thinkers and those who study conflate truth with risks and rewards. My point taken further is that true and false, hence what we call belief, play a poor secondary role in human decisions. It is the payoff from the true and the false that dominates, and it is almost always asymmetric, with one consequence much bigger than the other, that is, harboring positive and negative asymmetries, fragile or anti-fragile. Let me explain. Fragility, not probability. We check people for weapons before they board the plane. Do we believe that they are terrorists, true or false? False, as they are not likely to be terrorists, a tiny probability. But we check them nevertheless because we are fragile to terrorism. There is an asymmetry. We are interested in the payoff, and the consequence or payoff of the true, that they turn out to be terrorists, is too large, and the costs of checking are too low. Do you think the nuclear reactor is likely to explode in the next year? False. Yet you want to behave as if it were true and spend millions on additional safety, because we are fragile to nuclear events. A third example. Do you think that this random medicine will harm you? False. Do you ingest these pills? No, no, no. If you sat with a pencil and jotted down all the decisions you've taken in the past week, or, if you could, over your lifetime,